One of the things that's interesting about the story of Poik, and certainly about that beginning place, is that place that several of you were talking about, that feeling of torn between worlds. And the feeling, and the thing that he does something wrong. So he drives off, so it's the unconscious action. Now, it's very easy to say, oh, he shouldn't have done that. If he hadn't done that, all would have gone well for him. But actually, it's because he followed the unconscious action, the unconscious drive, that he entered into a process which ultimately leads to him being Pen Anuvin, Lord of Annwn. I suppose it points to the place in us where we follow things and it's not we do something and sometimes we regret what we've done. But maybe there is a deeper kind of purpose. It's a challenging thing in some ways because the story would challenge us then to trust our apparent mistakes. But the key thing in this story is not to keep repeating them. Because what you see happening with Poik is that he learns. Because what happens to him after the scene where he drives off the hounds of Annwn and then is challenged by Arawn is he's then under an obligation to Arawn, in a sense a form of imprisonment. So for a year and a day he has to change places with Arawn. And has to go into his land, and he has to challenge Arawn's enemy, who is Havgan, Lord of Summer. And right at the beginning of the Mabinogi, we have this business about appearance and identity, because the changing places involves a change of shape. So his shape is taken from him, and he takes upon himself the shape of Arawn, Lord of the Underworld. The Lord of the Underworld takes upon him Poik's shape. There are two words you find a lot, particularly in the fourth branch, Middle Welsh word. One called anian, which means essence. The other called arith, which means appearance. And in some ways, you could say, just as Peter indicated, that the whole of the issue of polarities is about this issue of essence and appearance. And so we have it right at the beginning. There is this interchange that comes about. So he takes upon himself the appearance. His anian remains the same. He is still Poik. Inside himself, he is still Poik. And then what happens is he enters into Annwn. He becomes Lord of Annwn, and Arawn says, I will give you the most beautiful woman in Annwn to sleep with, who is my queen. I will give all my lords will obey you. You will rule as me for a year. But in the day after the year, you must go to a ford, to another liminal place, where you will meet in battle Havgan. And it is the peculiarity of Havgan that if you strike him more than one blow, he will revive. You must strike him a deadly blow, but one blow only. So it's a strange little kind of story. But the nub of the story, in a way, is that he does take upon himself this shape. He does enter into Anuvin as Arawn. The thing that he doesn't do, there's one thing that he doesn't do. He all through the day he is Arawn. He talks to the queen. He acts as a ruler would. In nighttime, when he goes to bed with the most beautiful woman in the world, instead of making love to her, he turns away from her. Now this is sometimes put in as a sort of a later Christian gloss, but actually it is one of the key. It's one of the key points of the story. Because what he has to do is literally restrain his sexual energy and restrain himself into his own identity and not get lost in the identity of Arawn. The other place where he has to do this is in the battle at the ford where he fights Havgan the Summer King. So he is the sort of underworld lord, he is the Gwynab Nydd figure in a way. who challenges the Summer Lord, and he strikes him a great blow, a mortal blow. And then Havgan tries to persuade him to give him the coup de grace, the mercy stroke. Again, in we wouldn't understand this now, but again, in medieval chivalry, if you're mortally wounded your opponent, you're under a chivalric obligation to discover the coup de grace. It is literally the cut of grace. So actually, to not do that would be seen as a dishonourable thing. But what is being spoken of here really is the capacity to restrain your energy, because this story is all about this sense of lordship and containment and direction of will. Now, had he slept with Arawn's wife, in a sense, what would have happened to him is he would have... It's the same prohibition that you get in fairy tales, where if you eat the fairies' food and drink, you become like them and you never find your way home. So what he has to do all year is restrain his energy, hold his energy back, and in that place keep his own mortal identity. And work with the tension of wanting to sleep with the most beautiful woman in the world and knowing that if he does do that, he will lose himself and will never find his way back to the human world. He will be, his identity in a sense will become submerged in the identity of Arawn. Similarly, if he strikes more than one blow against Havgan will be renewed and come to life and will defeat him. So he has to use his will, use his energy, and then hold it back. And it really is about speaking about this energy of will that we have, this powerful creative energy, which is connected with our own sovereignty. And can we direct that energy? Really challenges us to exert our energy and hold it back. Not out of morality, actually, but out of being truthful to our own identity. You know, it's the place, you know, there's echoes here of, you know, the place if you fall in love with somebody, you can lose yourself in the other. So it has that place of the need to love and to be yourself and to love them and let them be themselves, rather than the place of the place of desire taking you into the other so you lose your sense of who you are. So it's a very powerful kind of thing that's being asked of Porcia. Yeah. And as a result of him doing that, he, in a way, he learns to become master of Anuvin. He is then the master of the two realms, in a sense, because he has managed to be the lord of Anuvin and to retain his human sovereignty. So he gets a new title. He retains his name Poich, but he is now Poich Penanuvin. And now there is a sort of interchange between the world of Anuvin and the world of Duvid, and in particular the riches of Anuvin, the gifts of the other world start flowing into Duvid. In particular, he gets given a lot of little pigs. And pigs are very important figures for the Celts. They're heroic beasts. They represent the creativity of the earth, the life of the earth. And in the world of the Mabinogion, pigs have never existed before. So something new comes into the world. Bacon. Horrible thing to say. Poor piggies. So there's something important, very powerful, that comes in there as that act. Now, because of that act, something is now, if you like, an opening between the world of Anuvin and the human world. And the second act of Poich has him on the Mound of Wonders, being challenged. This is where we learn a little bit about the Mound Arbeth, because one of his companions says to him, "It is known, Lord, that if a high-born man stands on the Mound Arbeth, he will either receive a great blow or see a wonder." This is equivalent to sitting underneath Arthur's chair. So it's actually quite a magical act. He stands in the middle of his realm on the Mound of Wonders, waiting for a wonder. And the wonder that appears is Rhiannon on her horse. And he sends people to chase Rhiannon and to ask her to come to him. And finally gets on his horse himself to chase her down. And although she appears just to be riding very steadily, very quietly, he cannot catch her. Now, Rhiannon's name, the Rhi means queen. She is the great queen of the Celts. She is the connected probably with the older Celtic goddess Epona, who is the goddess who rides the white horse. So she is this, and she is very much connected with the energy of generation, of creativity, of childbearing, of life. And what has to happen in the second act is that he cannot catch her, because actually she is beyond him. Like, she is this energy of sovereignty. You know, you find it in Irish tradition. One of the ways in which, in very early days, the High King had to mate with a mare in order to be united to the land, and in order to receive the blessing of Epona. So this is a very similar kind of image. But what he has to do is to stop chasing. So this is a similar action. Right, he has to draw and then ask her, for the sake of the man that you love the best, will you please come and have conversation with me? So there's a movement there of vulnerability. So instead of, so that pursue just doesn't happen. And he has to come to, in a sense, to a sense of stillness in himself, and to say, please will you come to me for the sake of the man you love the best. He's of course hoping there isn't a man she loves the best when he does that, and hoping it might be him. But nonetheless, and in that moment, he has to make himself quite vulnerable. So he has to, again, to restrain his energy and use a different quality inside himself. And so he does quite well there, eventually. And then they agree to marry, and in a year and a day, he will go into Annan, to the court of her father, Hive the Hain, Hive the Old, and there will be a great marriage feast, and all's looking very well. They all go for the marriage, having a wonderful marriage feast, and he has a few too many, and he's in that kind of expanded poet place again. He's lost sense of centre, and because a figure called Gwawl, who is an old lover of Rhiannon's, comes to him, because it's traditional at a feast that the people will come and ask boons from the man in charge of the feast, which is Porch in this case. And have anything, go on, have anything, he says. Excellent, says Gwawl. I would like your wife and all the fittings for the feast. And of course, one of the things about the Celtic tradition is giving your word is a very serious business. Actually, and were he to break his word, then it's the equivalent of annihilation. So this whole branch is about this energy of will and expression, and if you don't restrain that energy, you get yourself into all kinds of trouble. Now, what happens then? Because Rhiannon, of course, is much brighter here than Porch, and she accepts the situation, but says to Gwawl, "Well, we cannot be married now, because this feast is for Porch and his retainers. I will marry you in a year and a day." It's interesting. It's this is the international folktale thing of a year and a day, because it's a cycle and then a day out of time. So the transition moments always happen in the day out of time. Now, Rhiannon says to Porch in the meanwhile, okay, come to the feast, but this is what you're going to do. And she gives him this bag, and the bag is interesting. The bag is one of the repeating motifs you get in the Mabinogion, because the bag is another version of the cauldron. It's the thing. It's the container out of which the fruits of the earth come. It's the womb. It's the sort of. It's given by the great queen Rhiannon, who is the horse goddess, who's responsible for the fertility of the land. And she says to him, what you must do is come as a beggar to this court, come as a ragged beggar, and offer and ask a boon from Gwawl, ask him to as much grain and food that would fill this little bag. And the bag will not fill. And you must tell him that the only way this bag will fill is if a chieftain of high rank gets into the bag and treads it down with his own feet. Now, this all happens, and what happens is Gwawl, whose totem is the badger, and who is another greyish brown being, like akin to Arawn, gets into the bag, and then they of course grab the bag, tie it up, and then they play the game of badger in the bag. Which is an horrible, nasty pursuit our ancestors apparently used to engage in, was they used to sort of beat seven bells out of a badger, and then decided to turn it into rugby later on, apparently. This is the mythical version of rugby. You know, so every time you see a rugby ball, there's probably a very little badger in there somewhere having a horrible time. Just think on. Not that I'm anti-rugby or anything, of course. But what happens there? There's another interesting thing that happens there. All would have been well if they had just imprisoned him and asked him to release her from her vows. But what happens is they cannot, Pulch and his men cannot restrain themselves, and they beat him savagely. And this is a very potent moment, really, where they offend Gwawl, and they and you know, he makes a vow that he won't take revenge upon them, and he will, and eventually gets let out of the bag. But because they have not restrained themselves, and because they have hurt him, in the third branch, a great enchantment falls upon Dyfed, and Rhiannon and her son Pryderi are taken into the other world and imprisoned. And so it's another moment where Pwyll has managed to hold it together and lost it again. And so there's this constant move of getting it and losing it, and getting it and losing it. And there's and we're all the time exploring this dimension of sovereignty, of lordship, of will, of wielding the spear of sovereignty somewhere. Now, so all goes well. They all, you know, Rhiannon then comes. Then there's an interchange. We can move from Annwn back into Dyfed, with Rhiannon coming into the world of Dyfed, and there's and so they live happily for a while, for a couple of years, and there's then a whole issue about the fact that no child and no heir appears. And one of the interesting constructions in the way this is written in the Mabinogion, it sounds like it's Pwyll's fault, because it sounds like Rhiannon has previously had children. And is it just the way the construction is made? But he asks his chieftain to give them another year, and she does in fact become pregnant. So the whole issue that we're looking at here now is aspect of lordship, is generation, is the creation of something that follows after you, a literal heir or legacy or that kind of energy. And what happens, and this is the direct consequence of the badger in the bag episode, and Gwawl himself can take no revenge, but Gwawl's got friends who have insulted the lord of the other world, should have been treated in such a shameless way. And one of the things that happens is that the after the birth, there are a number of midwives who are there keeping watch upon the baby while Rhiannon is sleeping. And an enchantment is placed upon them, and a friend of Gwawl takes the child away. What then happens is the midwives wake up from their slumber, having not been able to watch through the night. It's an interesting parallel there, actually, of the Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane and the disciples who can't watch through the night. Again, this would have been a very obvious parallel to a medieval Christo-pagan. But anyway, they can't watch through the night, and so what they do is they kill a hound pup and smear the blood upon Rhiannon's mouth and hands, and swear that in the night that she has killed and eaten her child. Powerful, graphic, horrible kind of image. But it's got a very ancient resonance in that the goddess, the great goddess, is the destroyer as well as the creator. She is the goddess who cannibalizes as well as gives birth. So there's a, so this is, you know, medieval story, and it's a shocking story, and it's a you know, the lies of the midwives, but it's also echoing a very ancient kind of image. And then a very strange thing happens. So she's judged, and but the thing is that she's held to account for this, and she consults with her own wise men and takes a penance upon herself. She effectively judges herself. And we might say to stop somebody else doing it, but that's actually what happens. These are part of some of the conundrums you get in the Memnogion. And it's easy to read past them because we're used to the wife who, you know, there's a big international folktale about the wife who is unjustly accused of killing her children. It's a very powerful motif, and of course this is one of those versions. But there are twists with it, and one of the twists is this kind of connection with the ancient horse goddess who also destroyed, who is the nightmare as well as the mare who brings fertility. And then the other subtlety here is that she takes upon herself this penance. And the penance is that she wears a sandal upon her back. And anyone who approaches the court of Pwyll, she will carry upon her back to the threshold of the door. Meanwhile, telling her story of how she devoured her own child. So it's a very mysterious, very powerful kind of shape. Because she literally becomes the mare again. She is the woman who is the mare. And she carries strangers to the door of the king. You know, there's a lot to contemplate in that. And one of the sort of subtexts of it is she takes them upon her back. Does that mean she has to have sex with them? It's one of the little edges of that. And if so, does that mean she's conveying a version of sovereignty? What is going on here? Now that's what you find a lot in the Mabinogi, these kind of things. And what is going on here? Is it that? And actually the key to it is to hang out with the dilemmas, to let the, use the word koan. They are like koan, like the Zen koans, where you find yourself not understanding or having to hold two or three possible truths at once. And the key then is just to stay with that and get interested in that and to see how it talks back at you. It's very much a speaking text, the Mabinogi. Now what happens, this is all kind of going on. And of course this story is being told throughout David, that the Queen of David has devoured her son, and is now doing this penance. And eventually it comes to the ears of Tristram. I always forget this guy's name. Let's find it. Oh yeah. Comes to the ears of Tairnon Tufchliant, who was lord over Gwentiscoid, who is the lord of Gwent, who is the best man of the world. In his house he had a mare, and throughout his kingdom no stallion or mare was more handsome. Every May Eve she would give birth, but no one knew at all what had become of her foal. One evening, Tairnon spoke to his wife. "My wife," he said, "we are careless losing our mare's offspring every year without keeping one of them." "What can we do about it?" she said. "God's vengeance upon me," he said, "if I don't find out what fate befalls the foals. Tonight is May Eve." He had the mare brought indoors and he armed himself and began the night's vigil. And as it begins to get dark, the mare gives birth to a big, perfect foal, which stands up on his feet immediately. Tynon gets up to examine the sturdiness of the foal. As he's doing this, he hears a loud noise, and after the noise, an enormous claw comes through the window and grabs the foal by its mane. Tynon draws his sword and cuts the arm off at the elbow, so that a part of the arm and the foal with it are inside. Then he hears a noise and a scream at the same time. He opens the door, rushes off after the noise. He cannot see the cause of it because the night is so dark, but he rushes after it and follows it. And he remembers that he has left the door open, and he returns. And by the door there is a small boy in swaddling clothes, with a mantle of brocaded silk wrapped around him. He picks up the boy and sees that he is strong for his age. Now what Tynon is able to do is watch through the night. Unlike the midwife, he has this he's another figure of lordship, of and he's again he's connected with mares, you know, so he has this magical mare. So we're getting this motif repeated about the lord and the magical mare, and who gives birth to the perfect foal. In another, we've been given the image of, if you like, of another version of Pwyll with Rhiannon and the child, but as the mare and the foal. And what happens is, and it's because he's able to hold through the night and wield the sword which defends and liberates, he is able to hurt the otherworldly being that's trying to stealing the foal. And not only does, when he comes back, not only is the foal there, but there is a little golden-haired boy called Guri the Golden-Haired. And this, of course, is the child, is the lost child of Pwyll and Rhiannon. And so what happens is that as he grows, so they don't, of course, don't know where he's come from, but he's brought up in court until he was a year old. And before he was a year old, he was walking strongly and sturdier than a well-developed and well-grown three-year-old. After a second year, he is as sturdy as a six-year-old. By the end of the fourth year, he was bargaining with the stable boys to be allowed to water the horses. "Lord," said his wife to Tynon, "where is the foal you say of the night you found the boy?" "I ordered them to be given to the stable boys," he said, "and told them to look after it." "Would not be good, Lord, for you to have it broken in and given to the boy. For the night you found it, the foal was born, and you saved it." "I will not disagree with that," said Tynon. "I will let you give it to him." So there is a way in which the little boy, Guri Goldenhair, who later is called Pryderi, is also the magical foal. Because he is the son of the mother. He is the son of the horse goddess Rhiannon. He is a version of Mabon, son of Modron, who was taken from between his mother and the wall. And what happens is that as they hear the story, they decide that they realize that this must be the lost child, and decide to bring the lost child back to Arbeth, to Pwyll, in order to create friendship between themselves and Pwyll, and in order for there to be interchange between Dyfed and Gwent. So you're getting, what happens in the Mabinogi is the story, is the pattern is repeated over and over for us to get it in different shapes. So you get this kind of doubling kind of thing that goes on, and a doubling of the pattern. So you have the exchange between Anuven and Dyfed. Now we're looking at an exchange between Gwent and Dyfed. So you get trying to describe this interconnected world where patterns, where energy kind of multiplies and patterns repeat themselves. And the patterns are always either the patterns that disconnect and destroy, or the patterns which create relationship and renewed life. So whether the Badger in the Bag episode, we're looking at a pattern that repeats itself and continues to create mayhem. With the pattern of exchange, we look at connection and the whole being greater than the parts, the multiplication of above, so the energy of friendship and connection creating more and more life. So rather than them keeping the child for themselves, although they've no doubt got attached to him, they return the child for the sake of the friendship that it will bring between David and Gwent. And it's all, you know, he's obviously welcomed back, and and then he gets renamed. Again, we're with identity and naming. So he gets renamed by Rhiannon, who calls him Pryderi, which means anxiety or worry. You know, it's like the cry of mothers down the ages, you are such a worry to me. You know, the child, and there's just something about that, very, very touching little human bit, he's worry. But what she says is, I'm calling him worry because I am now free from worry. So it's all the time that this kind of, we've got to look into these small details, because it's easy just to think, okay, that's not. But then, wait a minute, she's calling him worry because she's free from worry. What on earth does that mean? So, you know, the thing is, one of our problems these days, of course, we have too much information. We're talking, these stories have come from a world where there was not much to read, to be honest. You know, a manuscript is very valuable. And if you had a story like this, of course, you would spend a lot of time contemplating it, being with it, puzzling out the small details. And in a way, that's some of the skills that we've lost. And that have to, and that the Mabinogi asks us to kind of recover. So the very name of Pryderi, he's named Worry because he's free from worry, for she's free from worry. What's it mean to call your son worry, anxiety? It's something to contemplate, really. Now what happens, just end on this, because this will take us quite nicely to the end of the first branch. He's given into fosterage to somebody called Pendaren Dyfed. And to this point you start to think, well, okay, I'm getting the picture. Because Pendaren is another word that means headship, lord, chieftain. And he is the foster father of Pryderi, who is the source. So he takes and brings up Pryderi. And he's given to Pendaren Dyfed in order to create another relationship, to create a relationship between the land that Pendaren Dyfed. So that the function of the child, the function of the magical child, is to unite things, is to unite opposites. So in his birth, so he is this child that keeps moving between. He's lost and he's found. He is the creator of anxiety and the reliever of anxiety. He creates relationship between Gwent and David, between Gwent and David and Anuvin. He creates relationship between the Hilbreth, where you find Pendaren David's realm. And so it's the child of light, and that part of ourselves that is like the child of light is a bridge between opposites, which is a theme we come to majorly in the second branch. But it ends anyway in him being given to Pendaren Dyfed, and all kinds of good things happen between Dyfed and the Hilberths. Pryderi was brought up very carefully, as was proper, until he was the most handsome lad and the fairest and most accomplished at every worthy feat in the kingdom. And years passed until Poich Pen Anuvin's life came to an end and he died. And Pryderi ruled the seven cantrevs of David successfully, beloved by his realm and all those around him. After that, he conquered the three cantrevs of Ystrad Tawi, the four cantrevs of Ceredigion, and these are called the seven cantrevs of Saeluch. Pryderi, son of Poich Pen Anuvin, was occupied with that conquest until he decided to take a wife. And the wife he wanted was Kigva, daughter of Gwyn Gohoyu, son of Golu Wachtadlin, son of Casnau Ledic, nobleman of this island. And so ends this branch of the Mabinogi. Just as we end that bit, the Kigva comes from Gloyu. Gloyu was Gloucester. So he marries into the east, which is something that again that gets picked up in the third branch, when Kigva becomes one of the major figures. So how are you doing with all this? Just blasted the whole of Poikrodovi. How is that?